Hi, this is Brent Barber, the founding director of the Bicycle Film Festival, and this is Resonance FM.
Is Resonance 104.4 FM. My name's Jack Thurston, and for the next half hour, it's all about the bike. Well, even though it's so freezing in London that you might be thinking about getting off your bike and getting on the funky bus, I hope you're keeping it real on the wheels. And I couldn't play this fantastic little funky gem without saying hi to John Winston from San Francisco. John's podcast called Bikescape is a kind of West Coast version of the bike show. And Jonathan's a kind of kindred spirit. I think he put it as a kindred spirit when he described the bike show. Anyway, we did meet up over the summer in Berkeley, just across the bay from San Francisco, where Jonathan works. And we rode around a bit, went down to visit the Missing Link bike cooperative down in Berkeley, but unfortunately I managed to lose the tapes of the interview that we did. So I'll have to just go back there and see Jonathan another time. Well, another star in the firmament of eccentric American bike nuts is, of course, the mighty Sheldon Brown. And the chances are that if you've ever been forced to scour the internet looking for an out-of-production Japanese handlebar, or you've been looking for precise instructions on how to rebuild your 1957 Sturmey Archer three-speed hub, it won't have been long before you've arrived at one of Sheldon's many websites. I mean, Sheldon is an extraordinary character. The first thing you notice about Sheldon, I've never met the man, this is just going through his online presence and his reputation, which goes before him, is that he looks a bit odd. It kind of starts with the extraordinary chin, neck, jowl beard that's sort of red colour and it seems to extend, I don't know, how far down his body. And then there's an eagle statuette that he apparently always wears on his red helmet. He's got an amazing collection of bikes. I don't know how many there are. There must be a few dozen, from historical curiosities to kind of homemade experiments. And two of my favourites are the fixed gear tandem, which has got to be something else to ride, and a bicycle that boasts two sets of handlebars, even though it's only meant for one rider. So you have the choice whether you're going to ride the bike with the drop handlebars or the straight mountain bike handlebars. choice being the operative word, also eccentricity. Anyway, today in a bike show first, it's an enormous pleasure to have Sheldon on the bike show paying homage to the great tradition of English workhorse bicycles.
Today I want to talk about English three speeds. Today I want to talk about English three speeds. The classic English three-speed was made pretty much through the entire length of the 20th century. The three-speed hub was invented just around 1900. Actually, English bicycle manufacture pretty much ended around 2000 when the great factory in Nottingham, the Raleigh factory, was shut down. Throughout that time, the classic English three-speed bike was the transportation bicycle. The dominating manufacturer was Raleigh in Nottingham, England. Their enormous factory in Nottingham was, for a long time, the largest industrial building in the world. In that Nottingham factory, they built pretty much every part of the bicycle, up until at least sometime in the early 60s. This is not the way the bicycle industry is run now. These days, when you buy a bicycle, the name that's painted on the down tube of the frame is usually going to be the name of a trading company. If it is a manufacturer, it's a manufacturer that basically buys the tubing from a tubing company and welds or otherwise connects the tubes together to make a bicycle frame, paints it, and then buys all of the other parts to make a complete bicycle from different parts manufacturers. That was not the way Raleigh did it. Raleigh made the spokes, they made the rims, they made the handlebars, they made the cranks, they made the sprockets, they made the gears, they made pretty much everything. The only parts they didn't make were the tires, which came from Dunlop, but they had a very tight relationship with Dunlop, and the saddles were from Brooks generally, and they also had a very strong relationship with Brooks, and in fact later on Raleigh owned Brooks for a long period of time. Today I want to talk about English three speeds. Today I want to talk about English three speeds. These bikes had a kind of integrity that you don't really see nowadays. Bikes nowadays are designed and built to sell. The designers basically look at ways they can make a bike jump out at you on the sales floor. And once you've plunked down your credit card and rolled out the door, their job is done and they really don't care anymore. That was not the case with the classic English three speeds. The people who built these bikes, the people who worked in the factories, also used the same bikes to get to work every morning and to go home at night. These bikes were not built to be toys or sporting equipment. They were built to be solid transportation vehicles. They were built for reliability and durability above all else. They weren't designed to be especially pretty. Most of them were black, but with very sturdy stove enamel paint jobs that would resist scratching. Indeed, I often say they were built to last 100 years, and probably many of them will. Today I want to talk about English three speeds. Research and development divisions of Raleigh and other British manufacturers continued to find ways to make them better all through the first half of the 20th century. Sometime around the early 60s, though, maybe the middle 60s, there was a fundamental change in philosophy. They decided they were good enough, and now they would start finding ways to make them cheaper. And they started looking for corners to cut, and the quality started a long, slow slide, which eventually led to the demise of the British bicycle industry. This actually is a pattern that was followed through much of British industry. It's also true of the motorcycle trade and the automobile industry. They came upon hard times, primarily because they decided they did not have to innovate anymore. This wasn't unique to England. The same thing happened to the French, and to a lesser extent to the Italians, although a little bit later in the case of the French. English three-speed bikes were not always available in the United States. The United States underwent a long dark ages of cycling. We were leaders in the cycling industry in the late 19th century, and up until perhaps the First World War. But we were also, of course, leaders in the automotive industry. and the automotive industry pretty much eclipsed the bicycle industry. And from the time of the First World War and increasingly through the 50s and even into the 60s, the bicycle was basically considered to be a toy for children. You would almost never see an adult riding a bicycle. It would be considered childish and eccentric. This began to change, however, during World War II. The typical products made by the U.S. industry in this era were heavy, super strong bikes that were made with styling to make them look like motorcycles and to be very, very sturdy so that they would not break when children abused them. They were typically sized for children. Even the so-called full-size ones had dropped frames with a very low saddle. They were heavy and slow, but the manufacturers didn't care about that because they didn't expect anyone to actually use them to try to get anywhere. They were intended to just ride around the block or a couple blocks to the ball field or to school or whatever for children. This all began to change during World War II because hundreds of thousands of American servicemen found themselves in England in a time of gasoline rationing, or should I say petrol rationing. To get around, they pretty much all wound up picking up used bicycles. And the bicycles they got were the classic English three-speeds that had been left behind by British soldiers that had gone off to fight in North Africa or Burma or wherever. These bicycles were a revelation to Americans who had been brought up with these clumsy, clunky tank bikes put out by the U.S. manufacturers. And when the war ended, many of them actually brought bicycles back with them. Even the ones that didn't bring bicycles back started looking at their dealers to try to find a source for them. And British bicycles began to be imported again into the United States in ever-increasing numbers, all through the late 40s into the 50s. It was still a small niche market until the great bike boom of the early 1970s. Unfortunately, the great bike boom of the early 1970s also coincided with the rise of the 10-speed bike. Basically, in 1974, every baby boomer bought a 10-speed bicycle. Many of these people would have been much better off buying a 3-speed bicycle because most of these people were not serious cyclists, not hardcore cyclists, and the riding position and general configuration of the racer-type bicycle is not generally comfortable for a rider who doesn't do a lot of cycling or is not into speed. As a result, many of these baby boomer 10-speeds wound up spending most of their lives hanging up in garages or rusting away in cellars and attics. The people who had bought them would probably have been better served by a more traditional English 3-speed. It did not seem to make sense at the time to go for the 3-speed because it's obvious that 10 is more than 3, and the cost of the bikes was pretty comparable. The fact is that the 3-speed internal gear mechanism is a very complicated piece of machinery and involves a lot of small parts that have to be made of very high-quality steel. Whereas a derailleur system can be made mainly out of cheap stampings or even plastic parts. So in practice, it turns out that the 10-speed bikes were not really any more expensive than the 3-speeds, but they were much more fragile. Now we're coming to a time when there seems to be a move toward bringing back internal gears. Shimano and the new owners of Sturmey Archer and SRAM are all offering multi-speed hubs, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 speeds. There's a German company, Roloff, that offers one with 14 speeds. And it's to be hoped that there will be viable alternatives to the derailleur gearing. Internal gears have a number of major advantages over derailleur gearing. They are very much more durable and require much less maintenance because the workings are all contained inside the rear hub where they're protected from dirt and kept constantly lubricated. Another major advantage of internal gear systems is that you can shift them even when the bicycle is not in motion. This is not possible with derailleur gearing. Today I want to talk about English 3-speeds.
Well, that was the fantastic Sheldon Brown, first time on the bike show. And Sheldon, thank you very much. And as a token of appreciation, this is a little tune that we hope you will like.
I was a young man back in the 1960s. Yes, you made your own amusement stands, going to the pictures. Well, the travel was hard and a mean way, still use the wheel, but you could sit down at your table and eat a real food made. But hey, you young people, ooh, and I just do not know, and I can't even understand you when you try to talk slow. Was Bob Dylan, and I used to do gigs too before I made my first million. That was way, way back before Wild World War III, when England went missing and we moved to Paraguay. But hey, you young people, I just do not know, and I can't even understand you when you try to talk slow. Well, I got a secret, and don't give us that way. I got some real food tins for my 91st birthday. And your grandmother bought them way down in the new antique food store. And for beans and for bacon, I will open up my door. But hey, you young people, well, I just do not know, and I can't even understand you when you try to talk slow. Well, I was a young man back in the 1960s.
The incredible string band, Sheldon, keep the podcast coming. A few weeks ago, I was over in Brussels where I happened to stumble into La Maison des Cyclistes, which is situated in a beautiful little typical Brussels townhouse, and it's the offices of a whole bunch of bicycle campaigning organisations and a hire shop in the downstairs. So I poked my head around the door and see who was in, and Astrid van Herpen, who works for Pro Vélo, which is the French-speaking Belgian cycle campaigning organisation, was kind enough to give me a look around. And I started off by asking her what she'd noticed that has changed in the last few years as a result of her campaigning work.
What we could see over the last 10 years is that Brussels has developed a lot in terms of cycling. Cycling is still quite marginal in terms of the numbers of people cycling compared to other European cities.
And that's interesting, because when one thinks of Belgium, one thinks of an enormous passion for professional cycle racing, but does that not translate into commuter riding and recreational riding?
Well, it does. In Flemish cities, most of all, there are lots of people cycling in Ghent and Antwerp and so on. Here in Brussels, it was always different. It's a city which was very much geared towards cars. But over the last years, we see an enormous development. We see that cycle tracks are being developed. We have regional cycling itineraries now, which are in a course of construction. We try to contribute to that as well with our programs.
And for anyone who comes to Brussels, I mean, it's not an easy place to cycle in lots of ways. There's quite a few hills, and there's all this pavé.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe that's the reason that compared to other or Flemish cities, it's not so developed. But what you could see is that a regional cycling tracks, for instance, they try to find roads which are easier to do and which have not so much pavé or cassein, as the cyclists call it. Of course, you cannot remove all the hills from Brussels, but it's interesting to see that Brussels is not so developed in terms of cycling, whereas, for instance, Zurich, which is also quite hilly, has loads and loads of cyclists.
So over here are all the bicycles that are these for hire? They look like they're for hire. They're kind of identical bikes.
Yes, these are all for hire. So what we do here in the Maison des Cyclistes, we have a hiring service. We have about 100 bikes here. And during the weekends in the tourist season, we also have bike rental in the parks of Brussels.
Yes, just to take a closer look at them, they're the classic North European utility bike. Really good design with the dynamo kickstand, nice strong rack on the back.
Yeah, since we try to promote cycling in Brussels, we really want good bikes to be hired out. They're Dutch bikes, they're all from the same company. and we really want to show people that a good, comfortable city bike makes it very nice to ride in the city.
They've all got bells?
Yeah. That's an obligation for every cyclist to have a bell, legally, as it is a legal obligation to have two good brakes and light.
So tell me a little bit about the events that you organise.
Well, we just had our car-free Sunday in Brussels, where there were loads of activities going on also.
So were cars banned from the city?
Yes, they were banned, but not 100%. You could get, if you really had to be in the city, you could get permission to ride, but it was limited at 30 kilometers. An hour.
And so what was the atmosphere like?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's fantastic, and Brussels is really crowded with cyclists and people walking in the streets. And what is a bit strange to see is that this one Sunday, the whole city is crowded with cyclists and other public transport and so on, but most of all cyclists. That shows that we need more of these Sundays, because normally the cars are everywhere and it's not so nice to cycle, so we really need more space for bicycles.
And how about the famous white bicycle scheme? Is that that's something that happened in Holland, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where you could just pick up a bicycle anywhere and take it and then leave it, a kind of, you know, hippie idea in a way.
True. That was in Amsterdam, most of all, end of the 60s. In fact, I grew up in Amsterdam, so I lived through that a bit. But they all failed since the bicycles were stolen. And as a matter of fact, a couple of years ago, we had a similar project here in Brussels where there were bikes in boxes near the metro stations. Unfortunately, that project stopped as well because too many bicycles disappeared.
So if you want to hire a bike, you have to come here, hire it from here, and bring it back to here. You can't drop it off somewhere else.
No, you have to bring it back right here. I mean, we have limited stock as well. We have in total something like 300 bikes, and they have to come back.
And I think that Brussels is perhaps unique in being the only city that I can think of that has named a metro station after a cyclist.
Yeah, that's true. Eddie Merckx station. You can even see his bike, which he won some ride with, some contest with. It's actually in the metro station, so you can see it there.
And so if you were to recommend anyone who's coming for a weekend to Brussels, would you recommend them to take a bicycle as their way of getting around?
It's really a nice way to get around, because you can stay in the centre and there you can walk, but especially for the Art Nouveau buildings, which are a bit off the centre, it's an ideal distance to take a bike, because it's usually 2, 3, 4, 5 kilometres, and there it's really fantastic to go by bike and visit all the different
places. How much does it cost to rent a bike from here?
Our bikes are €3 an hour, or €12 a day. So that's not enormous.
No, that's pretty good value. Yeah. And that includes everything you need. That includes a lock and lights and a bell.
That includes a fully equipped bike, yeah. And it's best that you lock them properly because otherwise they will disappear. We also have bikes for children and trailers, you know, the small caravans.
Well, that was Astrid van Herpen of ProVelo. And you can visit them and hire a bike for the astoundingly good price, I reckon, of less than £10 a day at La Maison des Cyclistes on Rue de Londres, which is kind of in the EU quarter, sort of on the border with Ixelles, if you know Brussels at all. But anyway, it's pretty well located for everything. Well, that's about the end of the bike show for this week. This is Le Mont Ventoux by On Love Star. And remember, you can listen again to the bike show on the Saturday morning repeat or online via Real Audio streaming if you've got a modem, or by MP3 download if you're slightly better connected to the internet. The website is bikeshow.blogspot.com, or you could send an email if you've got something to say, or you've got something that you think we should be covering on the show. The email address is bikeshow@gmail.com. And various details about the bike show are on the website or accessible via the Resonance website. Anyway, that's the end of the show. My name's Jack Thurston. Next is The Clear Spot. And we'll continue with Le Mont Ventoux.
La vérité des illusions. Thank you.